Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Teresa, Heather, and Steph.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, and this week on Write Club, we're going to be talking later about themes in fiction. But before that, Heather will be reading from her work in progress, following which we'll offer our critique, as always. Teresa is going to be talking about comp titles. No, I have no idea either. Then Heather and Kate MacDonald will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. But first of all, Therese is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay, pens poised, ladies and gentlemen. Clue number one. Published in 2005, this humorous novel won the Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize at the Hay Literary Festival, the Waverton Goodread Award, and was nominated for the Orange Prize for Fiction, losing out to Lionel Shriver's We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Big size here.
Did you pick up any clues there?
Nope.
The humorous bit.
Okay. Right. Clue number two. The book was originally published in English, but has been translated into Russian and Ukrainian. The penny drops.
That's giving me an inkling.
Right. I can't remember who wrote it.
No idea.
Clue number three. Heather's still not got anything. Okay, this is a quote from the author's website. When their recently widowed father announces he plans to remarry, sisters Vera and Nadezhda realise they must put aside a lifetime of feuding in order to save him. His new love is a voluptuous gold digger from the Ukraine, half his age, with a proclivity for green satin underwear and boil-in-the-bag cuisine. Who stops at nothing in her single-minded pursuit of the luxurious Western lifestyle she dreams of. But the old man, too, is pursuing his eccentric dreams.
Right.
Well, I think it might be the history of tractors in the Ukraine, but I can't remember who wrote it.
Correct. It is A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, by Marina Levichka. Apologies for pronunciation.
Yeah.
Okay.
I enjoyed it, but I didn't pick up any of the clues.
No, it's good. And her second book, Two Caravans, I enjoyed as well, though I haven't sort of kept up. She's written several since then. The Ukrainian novelist Andrei Kirkov, reviewing the book in The Guardian, calls the book a banal tale that will not teach the reader anything about the Ukrainian community in Britain. Bit po-faced that. He states that the rhythm and dynamics of this debut novel are well managed and that Levichka is successful in setting up many comic situations, but finds the characters, such as Valentina with her enormous breasts and liking for green satin underwear, caricatures, and the novel constructed. But hey, I would recommend reading the short biography on Marina Levichka's webpage, which begins, Marina Levichka was born in 1946 in a refugee camp in Kiel, Germany, and ends, and this was written 10 years ago, I'll just say, I've been a successful writer for almost 5 years now, but I never forget that I was an unsuccessful writer for more than 50. It helps to keep things in perspective.
Wow.
So,
there's hope for us all.
There's hope for us all. But anyway, well done. Stephanie,
thank you. The only clue I got was the Ukrainian. I couldn't actually remember the title. No. Or certainly not the author. Okay, but thank you, Teresa. Now, Heather, you're going to be reading from your work in progress.
I am, yes. I mentioned last week that I got the idea of actually sitting down to write this by researching the things about flash fiction. Mm. Not that it's intended necessarily just to be a piece of flash fiction. The idea has been rolling around my head for ages. I've written my account of the journey travelling from England to Greece, and I've been trying to think of, you know, what I can write about the second part of it. So this is maybe the start of that, but I sat myself down and got my pen out and tried to work as quickly as possible. So here it is. Well, here I am in the overprocessed air of the airport that could be anywhere in the world. There are very few clues to the city or even the country. The interminable walk from the terminal to the gate has left me exhausted, and I have already achieved over 5,000 steps today. My feet are sore and my back aches. I used to think that carry-on luggage was a good idea until I had to juggle with a handbag and a wheelie suitcase that had a mind of its own, with no travelling companion. Husbands have their uses. I'm hungry and thirsty. I opted not to have breakfast in the hotel. I now realise this was not a good move. For the lone traveller, this is not an easy operation. I'm not sure I want to leave my bags unattended. I'm pretty sure there'll be a security guard somewhere, and he's not going to like that. I gaze around for someone who looks kind enough to mind my things, but it's not Manchester, and no one seems to want to make eye contact. So I boldly go in search of sustenance. I steer a tray along the counter and scan the contents of the cabinet in front of me. I know it's early, but the stale-looking croissants and yesterday's sandwiches do not look very appealing, so I opt for a fruit salad in a sealed container and a bottle of orange juice. Healthy, but hardly sustaining. I manage to reach a table without throwing the contents of my tray over some poor innocent fellow traveller and settle down to wait. It's times like this that I wish I was like the rest of my family and friends, and probably like most people really, and arrive at the airport with minimal time to spare. I, on the other hand, have an unwavering need to be early for almost everything, so I've got the best part of 2 hours to wait for my flight. I want to sit here and just look at people and make up stories of their lives. The jewel thief at the next table, the murderer sat by the window, the couple running away from their partners, the mothers running away with their children. But I decide this is probably not a good idea, and that the security guard is watching this crazy woman scribbling in her notebook. I have the urge to stand up and read the poem I've just written, just to prove that I'm not some sort of spy. I don't, of course. Instead, I take out my Kindle and read.
Yeah, I didn't read it as a flash fiction, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It seemed like the beginning of something.
I thought it was a telegraph just back.
could be.
Yeah, I think that it works really well in that regard, yeah.
I love the voice. I think it's got a nice kind of colloquial, narrative, comfortable, familiar voice, hasn't it? It's friendly. It's a friendly voice. Yeah.
I really like the jewel thief at the next table, the murderer sat by the window, the couple running away from their partners and the mothers running away from their children. And I would almost start with that because I think that's a hook.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Now, here I am sitting in the overprocessed air watching the jewel thief at the next table.
That's a good idea.
Because that absolutely would think, oh God, what's going on?
I wasn't sure whether it was complete until you said, and I didn't know if it was a beginning. I've got it, you know, it's a good read, but I didn't know, is it a beginning or is it the whole thing? And that sort of been,
well, I think Heather isn't quite sure herself.
No, that's it.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it has an end. I take out my Kindle, you know, and you know, this kind of slightly paranoid personas,
but I like that paranoid and thinking of everybody in the airport being sinister. There was a couple of grammar issues. I mean, does the wheelie suitcase have no traveling companion?
Yes.
Says I tried to think that carry-on, I used to think that carry-on luggage was a good idea until I had to juggle with a handbag and a wheelie suitcase that had a mind of its own and no traveling companion. So I think there's But I love the line, that little short line at the end. Husbands have their uses. That's great.
Yeah, I felt, again, there's a couple of places where a comma should be a full stop. Yeah. The beginning of the next paragraph, you should be three separate sentences rather than one, I think. You know, I'm hungry and thirsty. Stop.
Yes.
I opted not to have breakfast in the hotel. Stop.
I actually thought it might be nice to incorporate some of the images from the airport poem.
Right.
Now, I didn't go back and read the poem.
Well, there was a sticky floor, wasn't there?
And occasional children.
Occasional children, yeah. The best kind.
I just thought that it would add a bit more texture.
Right.
I thought it might be quite nice.
you say, it is times like this that I wish that I was. And I've put, it is at times like this that I wish I was. And crossed out the that. You know, it's just about, you know, making that sentence.
And at the end of that, you've got, I wish I was, and arrive. So you then move into present tense.
Okay. Yes.
So, but that's a syntax thing that you can sort out quite easily.
And I wasn't sure about on the other hand, because I thought, well, it's not on the other hand, is it? It's the same point. But then I thought maybe it is on the other hand. There are people who arrive early and on the other hand. There are people who arrive late and on the other hand, I'm early. So I wasn't sure about that. So maybe ignore that one.
I mean, it is just true that I'm always so desperately early, and especially if I'm travelling on my own.
I'm exactly the same. I know people who... you know, make flights and buses and things by the skin of their teeth, you know, throwing their bag on the train before them and all of that. And I could not live that way. I need a bit of time in hand.
Yes, so do I.
You say, for the lone traveller, this is not an easy operation. This is when you've said about being hungry. And it's like you've made a jump in your thinking from feeling hungry to getting some food, but you haven't made that actually explicit. Right, okay. So I knew what you meant. This is not an easy operation, getting food.
Exactly what I've put in the margin, getting different.
When I read that out.
Getting fed is not an easy or getting food.
Yes, when I read that bit out, I realised it didn't quite.
I found a grammar point.
Oh, good.
The murderer sat by the window, should be sitting or seated.
All right.
You don't think that's just the narrative voice, that sort of colloquial? I mean, I'm not... You know, but I'm sure you're correct.
Right.
Joseph at the next table, the murderer sat by the window.
The murderer by the window. Mm-hmm. But again, you lose that.
No, I think you do need a verb of some description. Mm-hmm. But
it certainly resonates though, because I do. I can imagine sitting in an airport looking at people, and I do it all the time and make up stories about them. You know, I made up a terrible story about a guy on the plane yesterday, and he spoke to me, and he was such a nice chap.
Did you tell him?
I didn't tell him that I'd been imagining he was.
Oh well, store that away. That'll come in handy sometime.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Heather. There's my notes.
Thank you.
Teresa, enlighteners, comp titles.
Yeah. Well, this was originally a post that came from writersandartists.co.uk about comp or comparative titles. Some people say competing titles, but usually comparative titles. And actually, if you search on the internet, you'll find endless posts about this subject. So what is a comparative title? Well, according to Writers and Artists, it's a fun and vital part of selling your book. The idea is that when you're pitching, and now you might be pitching to an agent at one stage in the process, you might be pitching to readers at another stage in the process. But when you're pitching, you compare your book to existing books to suggest the idea, to give them an idea of the tone, the style, the content of your book. So if I say my book is like Number One Ladies Detective Agency meets Eleni, this might suggest cosy crime, might suggest a Greek setting, but it might suggest darker overtones. I'm not saying that's a good example, but that's, you know, what I thought of. And if I really wanted to annoy Nicola, I could describe her tourist trilogy as The Time Traveller's Wife meets The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because she doesn't like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and so on.
Or The Time Traveller's Wife.
So that's what a comp title is.
And so I could say Lucky Grace's Call the Midwife meets One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Interesting
one. Which it isn't.
No.
But no, I could.
Yeah. Well, we'll work on that later. We can do better than that, I think, but maybe not today. So the top tips from writers and artists are tailor it to your audience. So if you're pitching at a general reader, you want well-known titles.
Yeah.
If you're pitching to an agent or a publisher, you need to show that you know your genre very well. So you're going to go into that in a bit more depth and not pick the best-known titles. And their second tip is don't choose the most popular titles, which kind of overlaps with the first one. But, you know, if you compare your book to Harry Potter, you're setting up a big expectation.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't choose two titles that are too similar.
Similar.
Okay. Because you're not showing what's different about your work. So they suggest one to set the plot and one for tone. So that's quite a useful tip, isn't it? One for the plot, one for the tone. And importantly, your book must deliver on the promise. So, you know, it's all very well to big it up, but then if they come to it and it's nothing like that, it's more like Barbara Cartland meets, you know, Mary Wesley or something. You know what I mean? You have to choose carefully.
Unless it is Barbara Cartland meets Mary Wesley, then that's fine.
Perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. So I found another post from Penguin Random House on this subject. Comp titles, elevator pitch is another thing. And they say the comps help editors making acquisition decisions to figure out who and how big the audience is for this book.
Yeah.
And editors also look at the sales trajectories of comp titles. So they're looking at if it really is what you say it is, then we can expect this level of sales. Mm. Also, the reps need this comp title pitch, because often when they're selling to retailers, they only have about 30 seconds to pitch a book. Mm. So they need something short and precise. Being able to say it's like X and Y can be very effective to get the attention from the buyer and set expectations about audience and ballpark sales potential.
Mm.
So they say when you're doing this, is Penguin Random House, when you're trying to create a comp title, they say ask yourself these questions. Are the titles you're comparing to recent, 2 to 3 years, they say?
Mm.
Is it the same format? So if you're pitching an ebook, don't refer to hardback only publications. You know, make sure it's the same format. Does it have the same target audience? So in terms of genre and in terms of demographic. So, you know, if your novel is not a young adult novel, it's not for a young adult reader, don't compare it with a young adult novel because it's the wrong demographic.
Yeah.
Is your comp realistic and believable? That's really important. And also equally important, are the books you've chosen successful? So don't choose flops to compare it to, because that's not going to sell anything, is it?
No.
So that's comp titles.
That's really interesting because I don't know. I think when people have said, when I've heard books or even films compared with, oh, it's a bit like this, mixture of this and this, I've never really sort of thought of it as being particularly meaningful. It's just a sort of quick tag, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that made it sound very much more significant than that.
It is a quick tag, but it's important to get it right, I think, is the point. And there's, as I said, there's loads of stuff on the internet about this, loads of advice. So
yeah, because it doesn't have to be like, it can be elements of. I've heard that this is a book about this with elements of another book in it, so which will give you a sense of flavor, I suppose.
And I think that idea of one for the plot and one for the tone,
I think it's a good
that's quite a good one. We should think about that for Lacking Grace.
Yeah, we should.
We, like it's ours.
Yeah.
But we'll all help.
We'll all share.
Of course it is.
Yes, it is.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you, Teresa. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning today, we're talking about themes in fiction. First of all, what do we mean? What is a theme? Anybody got an idea as to what they mean by a theme?
Well, I kind of, people do say, you know, what's your book about? What's the theme of the book? And they do ask that question. And for me, I unknowingly did have a theme when I started writing. And there are themes to the things that I like to write about. But it was only after I'd written them that I could identify what the theme was. So I like themes about, you know, secrets and secrets in families and how they send ripples out into families and, you know, things that are not felt for decades maybe afterwards. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things happen and then they have an impact. But it's because it's a secret, you're not sure where the impact is coming from. So there's a kind of element of mystery in that. But when you asked me the question, I did go off and have a look and I found one explanation on reference.com which said a book's theme is an idea that appears multiple times throughout that book, designed to ask the reader a question that is deep and sometimes deals with questions of right or wrong. themes emerge as readers make their way through stories. Mm-hmm. And I subscribe to that because, as I say, you know, the Black and Grace that I've written, to me, there was a lot of secrets in that family. There were secrets about her parents' marriage. There were secrets about things that her father had done before she met her mother. Mm. There were secrets from her childhood. There were all sorts of secrets that culminated in quite a catastrophic change in her life. And, you know, obviously the story is uncovering those secrets and lies and so on.
Yeah.
But for me, the theme is secrets make you sick. That was what I would say the theme was. And hopefully that the readers would come to understand that as they read it.
So the theme refers to the ideas in a book as opposed to the subject matter, the actual story. So the story illustrates those or gives an insight into those ideas.
Hmm.
So we're talking about those two different things, the story and the theme.
I think my stories, the theme is vulnerable adults. Mm-hmm. And I think I decided on that. Well, I did decide on that before I wrote anything.
Yeah.
So the stories develop themselves.
Mm. Yeah.
But the actual theme was in my head.
I didn't know that was my themes. It was only when somebody started to ask me the questions, I was thinking, well, what message am I trying to leave the reader with?
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that some writers do start with a theme and plot a story around that or a series of stories. And I'm like Stephanie, I have an idea for a story that interests me, and it's only later on that I seen the things that I write have certain things in common, and I know that I'm interested in those ideas, but I've discovered that later. And I don't think there's a right or a wrong, but it's interesting that different writers work in different ways, isn't it?
It's perfectly acceptable to do that. I mean, I understand the theme as being really the meaning behind the story. It's that next layer down. And I came across one Grace Jolliffe who says a story without a theme is little more than a list of events. The events themselves may be very interesting or exciting, but without the universal human connection they will not engage our attention in any real way.
Yes, it's about universal ideas, which
it's like sort of
transcend,
overarching idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something that comes through.
And I think as well, she says, not only must it appeal to the reader, it must also appeal to you. And I think that's what you're saying, Teresa, because you must want to or even need to explore that particular theme for you to keep writing.
Yes.
Your themes are emerging as you write because those are the things you're interested in.
Yeah. And I've got a quote from a website called novelwritinghelp.com by Harvey Chapman. And he says, the surface storytelling satisfies the reader's need to escape and be entertained. The subsurface meaning of the story satisfies their need to draw a lesson or conclusion from the events. And this furthers their understanding of the human condition. So we can see that something like an Agatha Christie story is entertaining, but it doesn't have an underlying message about human nature. I would say so. That's the difference, I think.
Yeah.
And there's something about the contract with the reader, isn't it? You know, in the first few pages of a book, you need to be saying to the reader, this is the style, this is the setting, this is what the story's about. Then maybe you would hint at theme then. In fact, in this book here, which nobody else can see, but I've got a book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel. And in there, they talk about the importance of stating the theme right up front in your story. Now, this book kind of recommends certain formulas for what page you do it on. But, you know, just by way of an example, Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, which is a kind of why done it mystery thriller. On page one, Rachel says, my mother used to tell me that I have an overactive imagination. Tom said that too. And actually, the theme of the book is reality and how easily it can be manipulated. And the three protagonists refuse to accept it. And it's Rachel that has to learn accepting reality and solve the mystery of, you know, what happened.
So it's right up front there.
It's right up front in that particular book. Yeah. For example, again, an example from this book, In the Help by Catherine Stockett, which is historical fiction. It's about I'm sure lots of you, I know you've read it, Heather, I've read it, yeah. Somewhere around 12, 15 pages in, the maid, Abilene, is asked by her mistress, do you ever wish you could change things? And Abilene says, well, that's one in her head, says, well, that's a stupid question, you know, things can't be changed, and tells her mistress, oh, no, everything's fine. And actually the theme, the primary theme of the novel is about finding the courage to change corrupt institutions. So again, it's what the writer of this book is saying is that you can see the thing stated up front. Now that may be so, and I think in Lacking Grace I probably have explained the theme up front. I hope I have, but I didn't do it deliberately.
Yeah.
It's just something that kind of came out, so I didn't go, oh, it's page 12, I need to state the theme of my book.
Yeah
And that could be counterproductive, you know, the big flag saying this is the theme.
I think it could. I don't necessarily
agree with that.
And
if a writer does that in every novel that they write,
well, you just turn to page 12, find out what it's about, and then move on. But you know, there was some quite interesting insights into how themes are,
and you know who
expressed.
Would love that.
Oh, Nicola will love this.
It's a formula.
It's a formula.
It's a map of how to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And lots of people like those kind of maps.
Yeah.
You see, if you don't have your theme in mind anyway, then one way of sort of making sure that as your theme emerges and you get to the end of your novel or way part through your novel, what do you do? Do you then go back and say, right, well, this theme's emerged. Is it clear enough? And other things?
Maybe.
So
maybe
when you come
you
back
to
edit, you need then perhaps to be more aware of your theme and make more conscious decisions about either plot or character and so on.
It could be as simple as putting a line in, like her mother always said she had too much imagination, you know, which is not too strong, obvious, maybe, but also can you have more than one theme?
I think you can.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think
you
so
can have
too.
A number of themes. Yeah. Definitely.
And the reader, you know, will take from it what they perceive to be the theme, the key ideas, weren't they?
Well, you've only got to read literary criticism to find that, you know, somebody's written something and then all these very clever academic people go off and explain to us what all the different themes, motives, etc. were. Yeah. And I sometimes wonder if the poor writer's thinking, oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know it was all about
I'm sure that.
That
does happen quite often. I'm sure it does,
If you look at something like To Kill a Mockingbird, you can pick out about four or five
justice,
racism.
The sort of loss of innocence and all that kind of thing, just very sort of easily they come through. One suggestion, if you actually start with your theme of how to sort of incorporate it, I thought was quite interesting. This gives an example of somebody called Jonathan Coe's novel, What a Carve-Up.
Right.
I'm not familiar with it, but apparently it's a piece of satire and proposes that the social woes of late 80s Britain can be attributed to the feckless upper classes. And so the author creates a family, the Winshaw family, a dynasty of influential men and women. And between them, they represent how the banking sector, the arts, farming, healthcare, and the news media have been corrupted by greed to the detriment of society. And says you can almost imagine Coe creating characters and storylines as a way to examine each point in his thesis. And he suggests one way you can do this or do the same is by mind mapping. Start with your idea and come up with all the ways in which characters might be affected by your theme.
Did you say that is a satirical novel? And I think that works, you know, that can work in satire, in comedy, you know, because it's very clearly constructed and you've got an example of, you know, in banking, in politics, in the arts, you know, of their pernicious influence, if you like. But in other kinds of novel, non-comic novels, I think perhaps you need to be a bit more subtle.
Oh, a bit more subtle, but I still think the idea of once you've got your theme, actually considering how consider how your characters, how your situations,
how they exemplify different
how your plot developments do relate to it.
I think Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng.
Something like that.
By Celeste Ng does that very well. If you if you think the theme is about babies and who they belong to, or you know, spoiler alert here if you haven't read it, but you know, there's a baby abandoned by its mother and adopted. There's another storyline which involves somebody who acted as a surrogate and then didn't want to give up the baby. There's a young girl who opts for abortion. So it's all around, you know, those ideas are there, but in a fabulous narrative with believable characters, you know. So, yeah, I can see how she has taken an idea and explored it in more than one way. And I think in the end, she doesn't make a judgment. She,
no, she doesn't. There's also in that book themes very like her original, her debut book, about the difficulties of being Oriental Chinese in American society. And that's the theme that was in her first book, which was Everything I Never Told You. And that was about growing up as a Oriental looking person, whether you were officially American or had come from China or the Orient. But that's another theme that she explores again in that second book. You know, I'm sure it's no secret that she's of Chinese extraction, so she clearly has a
an interest in
portraying the arguments,
and you know, and also another theme, if you like, of what's underneath these apparently perfect middle class societies and perfect families, and then digging a little deeper and finding the rot.
And you know, the Great Gatsby is a theme there that was talking about the corruption of the American dream and how Jay Gatsby's engaged in illegal activities and shady financial transactions to achieve the American dream. You know, so that was a that was as early as 1925. You know, so themes are not new, are they?
Oh no,
themes and motives
not.
Are not
way back.
And I think sometimes, for me anyway, sometimes when we analyse them, I think we're doing it after the event and perhaps being academic after the event. But I do take your point, Pat. Once you've written your first draft, you know, if you need to look and see if your message is coming across. Some people don't know that they've got a message, they're just telling stories.
But I think you're right, but I think unless it is just a straightforward light narrative, then they are the things that engage us, that interest us, and I think
absolutely
they will emerge, and they add the depth to the writing that will mean that it's not just a throwaway story that people will forget about.
Who you are and what you care about is going to come through in your writing. But by thinking about it a little bit, taking a step back and thinking about it, maybe you can explore, you know, acknowledge what those themes are, recognise, learn to recognise your themes and ideas, and maybe strengthen your exploration of them.
Yeah. And they add then to the enjoyment of the reader. They'll have more of an impact.
Yes. You've got this double satisfaction. You've got the satisfaction of being entertained, and then you've got the satisfaction of thinking about certain ideas or feeling you've learned something. Or
things reflect the human condition, course, and all stories are about the human condition. So it has to engage at that level.
So referring to your comment about lightweight stories don't necessarily need serious themes. In fact, again, this cat's eye reference from the Save the Cat Writer novel book says that the theme of Bridget Jones' Diary is how does a woman manage to get to this age with being without being married? And that's a question that's posed to her at a party, and she kind of feels that being single is somehow her fault. So the question introduces us not only to the establishment of the, you know, triumphant fall story, but also the lesson that Bridget has to learn is that she doesn't have to change herself just to get a husband. You know, so there's quite a serious theme underlying what appears to be a very lighthearted story. It's saying to you, you know, you be yourself and the right man will come along. Don't go trying to, you know, engineer a love affair. But it's told in a very light way. Themes don't have to be deadly serious or presented in a deadly serious way.
One example I read was actually about the film Titanic rather than a novel, and I would tend to think of Titanic as, yes, although it's a serious story, really think of it as deep and meaningful.
It talks about the plot being about an upper crust society girl who meets a working class boy aboard a doomed ocean liner and the resulting star-crossed romance. But thematically speaking, the story is a vehicle used to explore the idea of social inequality.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
And he ends up dying. And, oh, I've just spoiled it for everybody. He dies in the end.
But it suggests that the story, that romance, which could be just seen as fairly sort of it's not a superficial romance, but the idea of romantic stories tends to be a little bit superficial. Despite being a piece of fiction, allows an intellectual idea to resonate with an audience, and it makes us understand the social inequality through emotion, through that engagement. The intellectual idea is brought to life by a relatable human story, and that's the link, the relationship between the theme and the storyline, isn't it?
See, personally, I don't think we should get too hung up on the themes while we're writing, because, as I say, I think they will sort of tend to come out. But when we get to the point where we're pitching, just as you were saying with comparative titles, when you're pitching, you need to be able to tell somebody what the story's about, what's the theme of your story.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can be, you know, that can be a tough question to answer. But personally, I wouldn't like to have to write a story thinking, oh, I've got to hammer it home that, you know, keeping secrets, you know, affects your behaviour.
It's there. I mean, and going back to what you said about Titanic, I mean, it's motherhood and apple pie, isn't it? I mean, nobody would argue that social inequality is a good thing. It's a bit, you know, it's not, it's not a massive insight into the human condition, but I'm just being cynical about Titanic.
So what's the difference then between a theme and a motif? Well, are they the same thing?
No, I think the motif is something that recurs, or some things, because it can be an idea or it can be physical.
It can be an image.
Yeah.
Or it could be a day, you know, the daisy that crops up at different points in a story, for example.
And it recurs throughout the novel, and I think it leads you towards an understanding of the theme.
It could be a symbol as well as, you know, but a recurring idea is a motif.
But then epithets do the same thing, don't they? So, you know, when you say the big bad wolf, that's the epithet, isn't it? The big bad wolf, and you say it over and over again.
He's always bad, even when he's not being bad.
Yeah, because he's the big bad wolf. Or the, what's it in Homer and the Iliad?
Well, swift ships.
Yeah.
Even when they're tied up in...
They're swift ships.
Something like that.
So I think they're linked. Because as those ideas, as they sort of keep bubbling up again and again, they build up into something that the reader becomes aware of, perceives, and
links to the thing.
And then that has an impact on the reader, and they become, whether they're conscious of it or not, that there's an emotional response. So to sort of conclude it really is up to the writer whether they want to push the theme from the start or whether they just let it emerge. I think you have to be aware of it, though, and I think...
Well, certainly before you do the first edit, I think it's a good question to ask yourself at the end of the first draft. What am I trying to say here? What's this story about? Because sometimes if you have too many stories or themes or messages, it can start to muddy the waters. And I remember once sending in a story to an online magazine, and they came back and said, this is actually two stories and it would be better if you split one from the other and told the two separately, because in a short story, particularly, having more than one theme is too much.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, the theme was about, you know, people ignoring the person that ran their lives. So they were taking the mother for granted. That was one theme. And then the other theme was the fact that nobody in the family really liked each other. So, you know, it was too much all put together, where you can see in a short story, if you can stick to one theme, then...
You use the word message, and I think when you put a message in your story or your novel or your screenplay, that sometimes that pushes the reader away and it becomes too obvious. And if to refer back to little fires everywhere. I said she explores these themes, but she doesn't make a judgment. No. So there is no message like adopting babies is bad.
So
I think it's more a theme is more subtle than a message.
Yes, and, I agree. That's probably a bad choice of words.
Mm. No, it's just it just set that off in my mind to explore another.
It becomes a fable.
And what I was going to say, you know, you say when you get to the first draft and you need to ask yourself what the theme is. If you can't, if you don't know, if you don't really don't know, ask a friend to read it and say what the theme is. Because sometimes you're just too close and you don't understand your own motivations. Or, you know, speaking personally, I don't necessarily understand my own motivations most of the time. But, you know, another person can look at it and say, no, what you're really talking about here is dark secrets or whatever.
Or abandonment or jealousy.
And it, if necessary, you know, go online, look up examples of themes and see if something jumps out at you. You can find lists of them online.
Fascinating.
Yes, absolutely.
Good stuff.
Interesting.
Well, thank you, ladies. That, I hope, has been helpful for everybody. Before we finish for yet another week, there's just time for Heather and Kate to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Heather, over to you.
I'm reading Ill Met by Moonlight, which was written by Stanley, known as Billy Moss. It's a diary of when he was with Patrick Lee Fermor in Crete when they kidnapped a German officer,
Colonel Crepe.
Yes, and it's. I actually watched the film last week, which I've got to say was hysterical, because it was made a long time ago. Dirk Bogarde played Patrick Lee Fermor, and in the film they went round the same rock several times and they were to be on the run and along the same stretch of road. It was good, but it's really good that it was written. It's in the diary form from say Billy, who apparently Patrick Lee Fermor, when he read it, agreed that most of it was what happened. Said most of it. I don't know which bits didn't.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating to read about this guy. You know, this guy that.
And Patrick Lee Fermor, of course, wrote Mani, which is the book about the area where the Mani Lit Fest that we're going to in October is.
Good link.
And I think Patrick Lee Fermor, didn't write about the events in Ill Met by Moonlight while Stanley Moss was alive. He didn't think it would be fair to write his account. And I will just mention the literary cocktail I invented called Ill Met by Moonlight, which will be available at the Vanny Lit Fest.
Fantastic. I actually read, one of our members' husbands, who's a very keen fan of Patrick Lee Fermor.
Yeah.
And we talked about it, and he sort of said the same things, that, you know, it was an accurate record, and told me all about him and all about the people locally that knew him. But it's a good read, and it's a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Heather. Can I just point out to people out there, other lit fests are available.
Other cocktails are available.
And other cocktails are available. And now Kate is going to share what's on her bedside table.
Well, I'm finishing off one book and starting another at the same time. So I've just finished last night Marjorie Allingham's Dancers in Mourning, which is a detective novel set around the theatre and revue in the 1930s. And there's a murder, and it's not quite who you think it is. And it's just a glorious process. I know this novel really well. I reread it quite a lot over the, you know, every 2 years or so. And it's just the delight of seeing how she structures the reader, makes the reader think this way when you know perfectly well that's not the way you have to think if you want to know what's going on. She moves you around. So her technique is just a joy to watch. So even though you know exactly what's going to happen, it's just watching her work through the pages. I love that. The novel I've just begun is a science fiction novel that came out in 2016 called Sleeping Giants by Sylvain Nouvel, who is a Canadian author. And I'm about three chapters in, and it seems to be about aliens have buried enormous iridium bits of a sculpture in the Earth, which are activated only when humans have achieved nuclear technology, so that there's a certain amount of argon-37 in the atmosphere, which is generated by this technology, which activates the parts of the giants to emerge. And that's where we've got to. I thought, oh, that's a good idea, because any plot that involves chemistry, I'm definitely in that, because chemistry is my favourite science. But I love the way it's written. It's interviews with different characters and an unnamed interviewer. And you're finding out, obviously, the story as it unfolds in different from different perspectives. But you're also, who is the interviewer? Who is it, a male? Is it a female? What's their interest? And you're finding out. So you're being exposed to the story unfolding in different ways at the same time. And it's a good story. It's genuinely interesting. So I'm enjoying that a lot so far.
Thank you. Well, that's the end of another Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. In the meantime, please invite a friend. Invite all your friends to join us. Goodbye till next time.
Bye. Bye.